Last year, we brought our son up for lifestyle, and before I knew it, I was directing a choir. Like going on a holiday, you know, and you come back and you do some things you do at home. Well, that's great, but we're back to take Steve home now, and before I know it, here I'm talking on banking, and so we'll try to cover a few things tonight. But before we get into that, I'd like to express a little thought here. Steve's been lifestyle now for 9 months. Many people here have had a lot to do with his efforts and his teaching. All I can say from the bottom of my wife's heart and myself, that thank you very much and God bless all of you that worked so hard to help Steve. This will be a very informal discussion tonight, and Carol talked about a number of things that we should visit, but a few other people came to me and on a hike and the like, said, let's talk more about estate planning and planning for a person's future and death, really. And it's something that has been a mystery, I think, to many people. I guess we associate it because we don't like to always talk about dying, what happens at that time to your estate. But as many people say, and we try to say in our business, that really, in a light sense of the word, life is nothing more than a terminal illness. It affects all of us, and eventually we must make plans accordingly. It has been a mystery to many people, and I think we in the financial field have also been derelict in not talking to people as we have checking accounts, savings accounts, and loans. So tonight, I'm going to take a few minutes to informally talk to each one of you, whether you are young singles, middle-aged singles, or the golden age singles who have lost your spouse, whether you are young marrieds, middle-aged marrieds, or in the golden age who put your children out to school and they're home and just ma and pa at home now, because each one of you have a unique situation, which I think you should have some basic information. So we'll talk fundamentally gifts, wills, and estate planning. I won't ramble on for more than about 20 minutes. If you have some questions along the way, please raise your hand, but I'll leave some special time later informally to ask questions, or if you'd like to catch me later on, discuss further. Keep in mind, I'm not an attorney, I'm a banker. My specialty is trust work. This is also becomes a difficult task to talk estate planning to a group whose homes are in possibly 10, 15 different states. When we're home, we talk to people who are Minnesota residents. Each state has various probate laws which deal with the assets of a decedent. Basically, they're the same. Many states are now adopting what we call the Uniform Probate Code, which is comparable to many other uniform codes. And as this becomes more prevalent, it's going to be easier to discuss estate planning with everybody. But fundamentally, not only are we talking about a basic code, but we're all governed by one set of laws, which is the Internal Revenue Code, which deals with the estate taxes of the individual. Now that's the same for everybody. And in estate planning, we generally pattern our estate plans for the individual around those laws because they are by far more important from a tax aspect. So regardless of the state which you come from, if you listen to us and the thought of as the Internal Revenue Code applies to your own personal situation, I hope that you'll leave here with some additional information which will be helpful. What happens without a will? In many cases, it's something you don't want. In fact, most cases, state law will provide. Had I known we were going to have this little discussion, I'd bring a little humorous article of a fellow, what he really says when he doesn't have a will. But fundamentally, he says, I don't care where my assets go. Those little follow bloodlines, that's all right. But if there happens to be a brother or a sister that I don't care much for, or some parents who maybe don't need it, or Should I want to give something to my church, to my college, to a good friend, or to Holden Village, I really don't care. And I'm not too fussy about my taxes. Uncle Sam needs the money, so I'd rather pay it to Uncle Sam. Well, that's literally speaking what you're saying when you don't have a will. So what is a will? Really, it's a written document instructing the court, the probate court in the county or the state where you live, of what you want to do with your estate, with your assets, upon your death. If you have young children, it tells who you want to take care of your children. A will should be in writing. It must be in most states. And really, it can be, in a sense, and tape recorded, and it's under unusual circumstances, but let's say it should be in writing. It's not a joint instrument. A husband should have his own will. A wife should have her own will. It should be witnessed in some states by two people, in other states by three people. And it's generally safer and more advisable that if anybody is to receive something from that will, that he or she should not be a witness. There could be considered a conflict of interest. But more important, don't try to prepare your own will. Don't read some of these magazines or some of these paperback editions saying how to prepare your will. It isn't that expensive, and the stakes are pretty great. So go to an attorney. As an assistant in this matter, if you live in a city that has a bank with a trust department, each bank will be willing to sit down at no expense or no obligation and make recommendations on your own personal plan, which in turn then that you can communicate to your attorney, or and they in turn, with your permission, will go directly to the attorney. The net effect of this is you'll come out with a better instrument with two people's two heads together, the banker and the attorney, but more important, you'll reduce the expenses of preparing a will, because most attorneys will prepare a will and we call a time and charges basis. The time clock starts going as you sit down in his office. And if you can have some of the preliminaries taken care of, it will reduce the overall expense. So see your attorney and your trust department if you have the opportunity, if you're from a city that has a bank with a trust department. Otherwise, see your local banker. Ask him who is his big city correspondent that has a trust department. Then that banker will no doubt call the trust officer in his big city and lay the groundwork for an interview with a trust officer. Now, what is your estate? Really, your estate is the value of all assets less your debts, but what most people forget is the value of your insurance. Now, when you go to a banker and borrow money, you fill out a financial statement which shows the value of your homestead and your stocks and your bonds and your savings accounts and your automobile and your furniture. He might ask, how much insurance do you have? But the important point is, upon death, the insurance proceeds then become an asset, and they're just as good as money in the bank. So we talk estate valuations. Be certain that you include the face value of the insurance that is part, is on your life. And as we see more and more negotiated contracts, whether you're in organized labor or whether you work for industry which is not organized, it's not uncommon to see $50,000, $100,000, $150,000 term insurance policies on the life of an employee paid for by the employer. Or many times you'll find where you're involved in a pension or in a profit-sharing account, part of the profit-sharing proceeds will be used to buy a substantial amount of term insurance. So always, when looking at your insurance, consider that part of your estate upon death. Okay. So let's first talk now. I see a number of young singles in the audience, and fortunately, I think we might see a few older singles who might have lost their spouse or have elected to remain single for their lifetime. You do need a will, as everybody needs one. keeping in mind that each person has a $60,000 exemption. The first $60,000 of assets are exempt from federal estate taxes. But everything above that level is taxable at a progressive rate. Without a will, you that are single will follow bloodlines. They'll flow to children, without children, to parents, without parents, brothers and sisters, without that, aunts and uncles, and then to cousins. If you look at the chart, it branches out fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh cousins if necessary. But it does follow the bloodlines and not to in-laws of deceased brothers and sisters, as the case may be. Without a will, if you wish to pass some of your assets to a church, friends and the like, it's not available. The law says it follows your heirs at law if you die without a will. So I suggest the young singles and the older singles to prepare a will saying who should receive your assets upon death. Include those people that you wish to remember, and you can end at that point. Many times it becomes just a 2 or 3 page document, and most people in banking or in trust departments will say just a simple will. But include all that you wish to remember in this instrument. So you could buy pretty easy. Now we come to the young marrieds especially. Now, most young marrieds haven't had an opportunity to accumulate assets, say, of $120,000. But insurance builds this figure up, your net worth up to that amount quite quickly, or say between $120,000 to $150,000. You need a will, especially if you have children or you anticipate having children shortly. Your needs can be filled by what we call a simple will with a contingent trust. Let me tell you what that means. If the husband passes away first, his simple will say all assets should flow to my wife. If the wife passes away first, her assets will flow to the husband. Not difficult, and about the way you would like to have it go. But what happens if mother and father decide this is the night out, leave the children with the babysitter, and go down the street and some irrational driver, head on, accident, parents are killed. It does happen. We don't like to think of that, but we see nearly every week this happening in the paper. What happens to the children at home? This is where you want to expand on your simple wills and create what we call a contingent trust. The trust becomes effective only upon the death of both parents with children who are minors or under a designated age, which you can put in your instrument. Let's take this case where you might leave 2 children, 5 and 10 years old, 2, 3, 4, whatever the case might be. With the death of the husband and wife, then all the assets of the husband and wife will flow into a trust, which is established for the benefit of those children. Your will also say who you want to take care of those children. You won't leave it to the laws of the land or possibly grandma and grandpa to the children. Maybe they're not physically able to take care of them, although they certainly would like. You would much more rather have a brother, a sister, or a close friend with whom you've had an opportunity to visit and ask them if they would assume the responsibilities of guardianship if both of us should be taken. The trust then will be established for the benefit of the children, and the trustee, which generally should be a bank, would then distribute the money to the guardian as it is needed for the benefit of those children. I can give you one good example how this, what we did in our bank, and I'm sure other banks would do the same thing. There was a common disaster of the husband and wife leaving a couple children. They had visited with the guardians and they said, would you be our guardian of our children? And they said, yes. But we're faced with the problem. We have 2 children of our own, a 3-bedroom house. Where could we put 2 more children? Well, the we in the bank thought it seemed very appropriate that the two children of the deceased parents should stay together and should go to the family who were willing to be a guardian. We provided money out of the trust to the guardian. He put an addition on the house, and we paid for it out of the trust. And I'm sure the deceased parents felt that that was the most, would have felt the most appropriate thing. The children stayed together. They were with the guardian, and the guardian was able to accommodate the children at a level of which they had with their parents were living. So this common fund, this contingent trust, would be established under the husband and wife's will, does have some reason and good sense. The trust can go on to say that it should remain intact, making monies available for the children for their education until they receive to a certain age. And then should it be a substantial amount? Now what is that? Depends upon the size of the family. It could say that, well, after the children get their education, I don't want to lay $50,000 down on their lap. I'd like to have them spread it out for a while. So many trusts will say that 1/3 of the respective share for a child would be payable when he's 25, 1/3 at 30, 1/3 at 35. Or you may say 1/3 at 25, or 1/2 at 25, and 1/2 at 30. But it spaces out the distribution of the assets to the child so when he's of age and more mature to handle. This trust will also give you some latitude and say that even before the child reaches those designated ages, that if he needs money for an education, serious illness, down payment on a house, or entry into business, that he can, with the approval of the trustee, withdraw some of these funds before a designated age. So here again, now, young marrieds, $120,000. Maybe I should say why I picked the $120,000 figure. I don't pick it. The law says that this is more practical. The law provides where you have a husband and wife living. This is the Internal Revenue Code, that 1/2 of the wife's assets can flow, of the husband's assets, or the wife's as the case may be, but most of the time the husband has most of the assets. 1/2 of the husband's assets can flow to the wife tax-free. There's no dollar limitation. So 1/2 of 120,000 is 60,000 flowing to the wife tax-free. You remember earlier I talked about a 60,000 exemption. So if you've got 60,000 flowing to the wife and the exemption is 60,000, you've got no assets subject to federal estate taxes. And because there's always a few debts of an individual, we sometimes take this 120,000 up to 150,000, because the time you deduct the debts from the 150, you'll be down closer to the 120. So young married people, keeping in mind your insurance, talk to your attorney and your banker. And my recommendation would be simple wills with contingent trusts that would provide for your children in the event of a common disaster. But let's go on with that now to those people that have had an opportunity to acquire assets greater than the $150,000. Now, this is where estate planning becomes a little bit more complicated. And I'll try to follow through this in a manner which I hope you'll understand. When you get into this formalized estate planning, we like to say you should have some objectives. And I guess the first objective that always comes to our mind, we're bankers, but we're also family people. We're husbands, we're fathers. We like to say that the proper estate plan will first provide for the wife. Secondly, it'll provide for the care of the children. And thirdly, if you can accomplish both of those objectives, then it should save some taxes. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to benefit from the savings of the taxes, but it means some of those hard-earned dollars that you have will flow to the children rather than Uncle Sam. I think that's a pretty good idea. Property ownership in this type of a plan should generally be in the name of the individual who provided the money to buy that property. Now, what I'm saying is we don't like joint tenancy. We don't like to have husband and wife owning the securities with right of survivorship, because it does create an additional tax burden. Many attorneys will never
visit with people, prepare instruments without removing or severing all joint tenancy relationships. I disagree with that, and I think most bankers will, and most attorneys will look at possibly in this way, that we won't take the house, the homestead, out of joint tenancy, because that's almost like talking against motherhood. Mother wants a piece of that homestead. So we can carry the homestead in joint tenancy. But beyond that, you buy some securities, husband provides all the money for that, he puts the securities in the name of husband and wife. In effect, under the Internal Revenue Code, you are making a gift to your wife of part of those securities, which should be subject to some taxation. So don't make your estate plan built around what we call joint tenancy. Sever all joint tenancy relationships, or as you acquire assets, do not put assets in joint tenancy. Now, what type of a will do we call? We call the instrument for this couple that has assets over $120,000. The legal terminology is a marital deduction to trust will. Well, that's a lot of garbledygook. I'll try to say what it really is. Remember when I said the wife acquires half of the husband's property tax-free? The legal terminology, that is the marital deduction. So under this marital deduction will, we put that marital deduction, or that half of the husband's estate, in a trust for the wife. The legal terminology is the marital trust. Some attorneys call it the A trust. I like to call it just plain simply the wife's trust. So half of these assets flow to the wife's trust tax-free. Now, she hasn't lost any benefits at this time. She won't lose any benefits all throughout the entire estate plan. Of these trust assets are then invested by the trustee with the income payable to the wife on a monthly basis or a quarterly, whatever she might like. And she has the right, if you give her this right, to withdraw any part of the principal to maintain the same standard of living she was accustomed to when the husband was living. So the marital trust or the wife's trust then pays the income to the wife with the principal available to her to supplement the income and provide the same standard of living. The trustee will also have the discretion in a well-prepared instrument to make unusual disbursements to the wife in case of illness, or if she's accustomed to a winter vacation or a trip to Holden Village, because that doesn't cost very much, that she can make additional withdrawals from that, even to the exhaustion of the wife's trust entirely. The third provision under the wife's trust is that she has the full control of that money upon her death. It's called the power of appointment. So she can say that during my lifetime I'll withdraw the principal as I need it and use the income, but upon my death I want those assets to flow to the children. There you've got the complete disposition of half of the estate, which is called the marital trust or the A trust, but as I mentioned, I like to call it the wife's trust. Now let's talk about the other half of the estate. This first half went to the wife tax-free. But Uncle says, Sam says, you can only have a $60,000 exemption on your estate. So the other half of the estate, over and above $60,000, is subject to the federal estate taxes, and in most cases, most states, your state inheritance tax. Now keep in mind, we can't take that half away from mother. She might not have enough in the first trust. So the income from the assets in the children's trust, by the way, this other half is called the residuary trust in legal terminology, or the B trust. But for sake of our discussion, whenever I talk to people, this is the children's trust, as related to the other one, which is called the wife's trust. This is called the children's trust. But to take care of mother, those assets are invested with the income also payable to the wife. So in effect, she has the income of all the assets of the husband upon his death. Now we have one little catch. Because this was taxed and and she received part of the assets tax-free. She can't withdraw the principal of the children's trust unless she has exhausted all the assets in her own trust. Now, that isn't too bad. Say she does run into a series of unfortunate events and illness, and she has disposed of and used up all the assets in her trust. All she has to do then is to come to the trustee and say, my assets are gone, I need money for my support, my normal standard of living, and then she can go into the trust which was established for the children and withdraw the monies as she needs it. But she must have the approval of the trustee. There's one little catch there, but we're husbands, we're bankers, and we understand the needs of the wife, so it's very easy for the wife to withdraw money from the children's trust for her own support. But let's say that she might have remarried, and this husband, second husband, ethics or objectives in life were not as one would normally expect, and he wanted to reach into this children's trust. Well, if we sense a situation like that, we could restrict those monies payable to the wife if she had remarried and it looked like the monies would be exhausted, there would be nothing left for the children. So this is one good reason for the trustee to have control of those assets. So now our two trusts will continue to function in the same manner. I'm watching my time here. Okay. While the wife lives, the wife in her own trust has the income and has the availability of the principal. The children's trust would pay the income to the wife, and had she exhausted all her assets, then she could look to the children's assets for her support. Then the next step, what comes in a plan, is the wife does pass away. Her assets then flow into the children's trust. So you have one trust remaining, which again is the residuary trust or the B trust, or I like to call the children's trust. Now what if this event happens when we have, say, a child 16, 120, and 124? The 24-year-old, maybe the 20-year-old, has had some benefits of the parents' income for an education. It's come out of the family pot. But that 16-year-old hasn't had the benefits of his older brother and sister for an education. So a recommended provision in the trust would be that all the assets would remain intact in one trust until that youngest child reaches the age possibly of 22, so that the family pot will give the youngest child the same benefits that his older brother and sister had. Then, when that youngest child reaches a designated age, which in your instrument, say 22, it's a common time, then you will draw up that trust so that it'll be divided in equal parts for the surviving children. So the youngest child then hasn't had to pay out of his respective share for education that his older brothers and sisters received out of the family pot. Now we have 16, 20, and 24. The kids are 22, 26, and 30. Well, the 22-year-old, say he has a share of $50,000, $75,000. How many people would like to put $50,000, $75,000 in the lap of a 22-year-old? Now, there's some that are 22 years old here. I don't want to do it in my family, and I'm sure that it maybe wouldn't be used right. So most parents feel this way. So they say, no, that 22-year-old shouldn't receive all the assets. But when he's 25, he can get a half of his respective share. And when he's 30, he can get the other half. Or if you anticipate that your estate will be larger, you can say he can get a third at 25, a third at 30, a third at 35 for his unrestricted use. But before those ages, if he wishes part of his trust for a down payment in a house, a well-prepared instrument will give the trustee that flexibility. Now, going on a little bit more as to what other provisions should be in this will, you sure should name a guardian, in many cases an alternate guardian. you should have one provision in there, and this is unique. In case the husband and wife die what appears to be an instantaneous death, common disaster, that the instrument and the law will recognize, it says that if medical science is unable to determine the sequence of deaths, it is assumed that the wife will have survived the husband. Now the reason for that is, remember that the wife, if she survives the husband, gets half of the estate, his estate, tax-free. So if they both are killed instantly, but the law recognizes that the wife assumed to have died last, it'll preserve that marital deduction and half the assets will flow to that wife's estate, tax-free. So we have the common disaster thought. And then we have another provision which we hope never comes about, but many people as a slang terminology call it the A-bomb clause. So we have the common disaster thought. And then we have another provision which we hope never comes about, but many people as a slang terminology call it the A-bomb clause. And this is more important, I think, where you have husband and wife and young children, where generally you travel or are together most of the time. This common disaster might not only take the husband and wife, it might take the two children riding in the back seat, or they might be traveling on an airplane together. Then what happens? A A-bomb clause or a common disaster clause of this magnitude would generally say that maybe half the asset should flow to the husband's side of the family and half to the wife's side of the family. Well, why do we go through this complicated procedure again? Let me tell you what would happen if you didn't have the marital deduction will. Let's take a very extreme case, but many times we use an extreme case to emphasize a point. Husband and wife have $200,000 of assets. Either they're in joint tenancy, or another problem, which is just as bad, is that the wife is the beneficiary of all that insurance. So let's say that he has $100,000 assets and $100,000 of insurance. $100,000 assets in joint tenancy, $100,000 insurance, all passing to the wife. $200,000. Husband dies. She decides to remarry. Her second husband says, come on, let's put all these assets in joint tenancy. You love me, I love you. Let's take care of each other. So they're joint tenancy with the second husband. The wife then dies. All those assets will flow to the second husband, leaving nothing for the children of the first marriage. Extreme case, but it does happen. So this is why you want to direct your assets in your will for the benefit of your wife and benefit of your children. So getting back to why we do this, half of the assets flow to the wife tax-free. Half of the assets are taxed as they go into the children's trust. But where all assets flow to the wife, she must pay taxes on half of those assets. Remember, she gets half free. But if she gets all the assets, she must pay tax on half. But then when she dies, she pays taxes on her entire estate, over $60,000, and in effect, she is paying a double taxation on half of the assets that her husband gave her. It's just that simple, that all assets flowing to the wife will create a double taxation on half of the assets. Now you avoid that double taxation by making these two trusts, the tax-exempt trust to the wife, the tax-paid trust to the children. Upon the wife's death, the only assets that are subject to taxation are those assets that remain in her trust, which were never taxed the first time. The trust that's sitting over here, the B trust, or the children's trust, is not taxed the second time on the death of the second parent. This is the key to a good, effective estate plan. So, quickly in review, singles, young singles, middle-aged singles, senior citizen singles, generally speaking, a simple will be adequate for your needs. In this will, you direct the assets to whom you wish to receive them. If it's perfectly all right to go to your parents if they're living, or to your brothers and sisters, no problem. But if you have some special bequests to churches, charities, Holden Village, be sure to make your will in that manner. For the young marrieds, or those whose assets are in the $120,000 to $150,000 range, have what we call simple wills with a contingent trust. A simple will, again, is husband to wife, or wife to husband, as the case may be, but in the event of a common disaster, the assets are set aside in a trust for the benefit of the children. And for those people that have assets greater than $150,000, put them in, have a two-trust will, a marital deduction two-trust will, which establishes an A-trust, or the wife's trust, and the children's trust, with the various provisions that we've outlined. Wives, don't be afraid of when your husband talks a marital deduction will or two-trust will. You haven't really lost anything, and you are making a vehicle for those assets to flow to you and eventually to the children, with a minimum of taxation and very little loss of control. Let's go on to one other point, and then I'll open for questions. Gifts are a difficult thing to understand. We could spend a whole lecture hour on gifting. One of the first things that's difficult is, when do I start giving? Or when do I have enough myself to live on? It is to your advantage to start a gifting program when you feel that you have adequate assets to survive most emergencies, because even if you give more than the law provides on a tax-exempt basis, gift taxes are about 2/3 to 3/4 of death taxes. So if you give your entire estate away under certain provisions, you live 3 years, and we'll get into more of that, you will save from 1/3 to 1/4 of your eventual death taxes. But here are some of the basic provisions which sometimes are confusing to people. Every individual can give $3,000 to as many people as they would like, not necessarily bloodlines, once or during a year, each year. I can give, if I have 5 relatives or I have 10 friends that I wish to give $3,000 a year to each year, I may do so tax-free. If I am married, which I am very much so, and my wife doesn't have those assets, she may join with me in that gift, and I can give $6,000 away to each person that I would like. This is called a marital deduction. So I can give $6,000, even though Hank, by the way, Hank's my wife, for those who are just new here, I can give $6,000 away to anybody I would like if she would join in that gift, even though she doesn't have ownership of that asset. Now, that can continue on each year for as many years as you live. Now, that's one part of gifting. Now, don't confuse it with the second part. You are also permitted to give in excess of that a total of $30,000, not to each person and not each year. It's a total of $30,000. And here again, if my wife does not have those assets, she can join with me, and together we can give $60,000. That doesn't have to mean to charities. No problem with charities, of course, but this is to any individual. So putting that in an example, take reducing it just to my own case. I have two children. We have two children. The first year, I can give Steve and Carrie $3,000 each, and I can give $30,000. So I can give $36,000 to my children. $3,000 to Steve, $3,000 to Carrie, and $30,000 divided any way that I would like. But each year thereafter, I would be restricted only to $3,000 for each of those two children. My $30,000 has been used up. But that doesn't mean I have to get the $30,000 one year. I could give them $10,000 of that this year, $10,000 next year, and $10,000 the third year, or I can space it out. So there are two different parts of the gifting program. Now, there's one catch. Uncle Sam says, you go to the doctor and you find out you have a terminal cancer. You have only 2 years to live, 6 months to live. Uncle Sam, well, great, I'm going to give all my assets away. I'll avoid all my estate taxes. Uh-uh. You must live 3 years beyond the date of the gift. Otherwise, Uncle Sam says that's a gift in contemplation of death, or you little stinker, you try to avoid some estate taxes. So, but we have been able to upset Uncle Sam's ruling on this in a few instances where a husband and wife or an individual will start a gifting program early in life or at one time and continue over a period of years. Our last example, I think, is that they started giving $3,000 a year away to these people 10 years ago, and they'd repeated that $3,000 each year. Well, that was a program that was started long before death was contemplated, and that there was a death in the 10th year. We were able to sustain our position and allow each one of those gifts to avoid taxation because the program had been started and continuing on. But if a large gift was made, or even a $3,000 gift was made within the 3 years, it's difficult to say no to the tax people because they're going to tax that in your estate as if you hadn't given it away. They don't reverse the gift. They don't say, well, you gave the money, you got to take it back. No, they say that that asset is a part of your estate and is taxable under the estate tax laws. Well, gentlemen and ladies, we hope that this has been just a brief outline of what estate planning should be. Quickly, a will as a written document, witnessed by two or three people, and please have it prepared by an attorney. Don't try to do something yourself with it. Everybody should have a will, whether you're single, 21, middle-aged, or your family situation has changed. Husband and wives should have wills, whether you're young children, middle-aged, or your children have gone on their own separate ways. And an attorney will be the best person to prepare these instruments for you. And should you feel that you have adequate assets to maintain yourself and the standard of living that you would like, and upon the husband's death or the wife's death, sufficient assets to maintain the standard of living for the surviving spouse, start a gifting program. Because the gifting program will be beneficial to your children or to your grandchildren. You will have the joy of giving during your lifetime, and you will reduce your eventual estate taxes by a third to a fourth on any part of money that you give away. Any questions? Yes, sir. Giving away land, determine the, get an agreed an appraisal on the land, perfectly all right. I've seen many people who will, yeah. I've seen people, this is more very important in farming. Many people on the farms bought land for $100, $150 an acre. The last 3-4 years, it's doubled, tripled, and more than that in some cases. And they like to keep the family farm with the children. They will get an appraisal of the land, sell the land to a son, take a note. Maybe the note's for $50,000, $60,000. and reduce it by the amount of the gift each year as if the child had made a payment. Or it's possible to make a larger gift and pay the gift tax. But land turns out to be a good instrument to use given by the promissory note. One good way to do it. Yes, Pastor Agnes. No gift tax to anything payable to a charity. An accepted charity. Well, some of these holy roller groups, we say, or some of these that other proofs that are not approved by the federal government or the state, you can't get a charitable deduction on that. Yes, sir? Yes. Yeah. That is true. Yes. All right, let me allude to that just a little bit. This is the commercial. You brought me in very nicely. Most of you wouldn't use the First National Bank of Minneapolis, and thank you, Carol, for your kind words. We in First Minneapolis have been very close to the churches of. See, we were the base of the old ELC, and we are pleased to be the lead bank of the American Lutheran Church, who has offices just short distance from us. We are also the lead bank of the Board of Pensions of the LCA, and we work very closely with these groups. There are two positions that you should consider naming a bank for in your estate plan. First is called the personal representative. Now that's a new term to most people. The Uniform Probate Code, which is being adopted by many states, eliminates the terminology executor, executrix. Because there's also another confusing term. If you die without a will and the court appoints a person, that's the administrator if it's masculine, or administratrix if it's feminine. So you've got executor, executrix, administrator, administratrix, and if one person refuses to serve, you've got administrator, CTA, and you get a lot of other initials after. It sounds like an MD or PhD. So to eliminate this confusion, the probate code now says the representative of your estate is called the personal representative. It's that person's responsibilities upon the death of the individual to collect and value all assets of the decedent. Now the law is a little strange here too, but it does give the decedent's estate a little benefit. It says you may value these assets at the date of death or 6 months later, whichever is more favorable. Then the personal representative must prepare an estate, an income tax return for the last year of life of the decedent, an income tax return for the period of the probate if there are any assets that are generating income. Then there's a lengthy federal estate form which is 40 odd pages long. So we encourage you to name a professional as a personal representative in your will. You may also name the surviving spouse as a co-personal representative to give the insight of the family and the wife here, she feels she has a little bit to say on the disposition of the assets. The standard fee for most banks and attorneys throughout the country has been based on a percentage of the assets for performing that service. And it generally started at around 3% for the first 300,000 of assets and then went down 2% on the next 200,000, 1% beyond that. Now, these are just broad generalizations. Now, the accepted way in progressive banks, and I say that with all sincerity, because no estate is alike. One person's estate might be $200,000 in cash, and that personal representative shouldn't earn 3% for handling $200,000 in cash. He doesn't earn a salt. What he should be paid is what we call a time and charges. In other words, every person who works on that should fill out a time card, and they be reimbursed for the time and charges of the bank. But now compare that to the person that has $200,000 consisting of 15 different apartments down in the slum district. It takes a lot of work on the part of the bank or the trust or the personal representative to sell that. He earns his percentage, but he should be paid on an hourly basis there. So the personal representative will generally now be paid on a time and charges basis for his work. And his services generally run for about 15 to 18 months. Then, after the period of probate, which is this 15 to 18 months, then it's advisable to name a good bank as a trustee of either the contingent trust, if you have a simple will with a contingent trust, or if you have the two-trust will with the wife's trust and the children's trust. Here you can name the bank as the trustee with the wife as a co-trustee, and it becomes the responsibility then of the trustee to collect those assets, to invest them properly, make payments as needed, and where you have need for discretionary payments, where you must determine whether this is to the benefit of the wife or the children, use good judgment in that case. Fees on this basis run, established figures from 0.75% to 0.9% on the first $100,000 a year. Now let's figure that you have a $100,000 estate, it'd be $900 a year. Now that's 0.9%. But how many people have looked in the newspapers for the various types of investments that are available? You find a 5% savings account up to a 7.5% savings certificate. You'll find subordinated debentures or other types of investments up to 10-12%. I'm not sure I want to put my money in there. If you don't know a good investment banker who can buy the proper securities, turn over the investment of these trust funds to a good trustee. And when you say it only costs 0.9%, that's really a very modest amount when you want security and good management. And after the first $100,000, the rate goes down. In our shop, it's $900 for the first $100,000, $750 for the second and third $100,000. So if you should have $300,000 in trust funds, the cost is $2,400 a year, or 0.8%. Now that doesn't, $2,400 seems like a lot of money, but 0.8% isn't too bad. So the two appointments that you should consider any bank for is the personal representative of your estate and also the trustee of the trust created under the instrument. Any other questions? Yes. I say that I use $120,000 as the ceiling. Up to $120,000 for a husband and wife. You can use the simple wills with contingent trusts. Maybe $120,000, or maybe some case up to $150,000. You should have a will up to that level. Then you go into the more sophisticated estate planning of the marital deduction two-trust will when your assets are over the $150,000. But every person should have a will, especially every young couple if they have the children in the family. Yes. No, the executor is a person that's named in the will to complete all the affairs of the decedent. His appointment will generally last for 15 to 18 months. He again collects the assets of the decedent, he values the assets, he pays the bills, pays the taxes, and then disposes of the assets under the terms of the will. Many people will use a member of the family. We feel that this creates problems, not only because of the expertise necessary in doing all these duties of the executor, but once in a while you find the members of the family that become that will accuse the executor, if he's a member of the family, of partiality. And let me tell you, this happens in many families. One of our neighbors is a the prominent mortician in Minneapolis, and he said, you ought to see the times we had, literally speaking, fist fights in the funeral car back from the cemetery. So you don't do, and really, you don't do a favor to a friend by naming him the executor. Good. Good question. When you make an estate plan or a will, naming people as executors, naming banks, certain bequests as the case may be, you are not making a plan that's indelible, that can't be changed. A plan can be changed with what a will can be changed with what we call a codicil, which is just a simple document which will say, I revoke this portion of the will, paragraph 10, article 6, or something like that, and insert this substitution. Or it may revoke a certain paragraph entirely without substituting something. So a codicil then becomes the basic part of that instrument. A will also, maybe literally speaking, tore up. Let me tell you about a little incident, sort of fun. She's 75 years old, never married. Mother and dad passed away. Resident in southern Minnesota, southwestern Minnesota. Nephews and nieces, 16 in number, only relatives. She had them all named in the will. Her assets, about $550,000. Good Norwegian. Didn't name a church, college. I tried to get St. Olaf College in there, but it didn't work. But she wanted to go to, had to go to Mayo Clinic in Rochester for some hip surgery. So she put a wrote a little letter to the editor of the hometown newspaper. I'm going to be at Rochester Methodist Hospital for about 2 months recovering from hip surgery. I would welcome some cards or some visits by some of my relatives and friends. 2 months of hospitalization, no cards, no letters, no visits. Came to my office, tore the will up. Her doctor in Minneapolis, her surgeon in Rochester, the Mayo Clinic and the Rochester Hospital received every dime of the $550,000. This plan was changed just that fast. So yes, to answer to your question, it's a long way around. Anything that you put in a will today can be changed tomorrow. Yes, the bank's fee as trustee will not begin until his services are used. The bank's fee as the personal representative will not be used, not be paid until the death of the individual. And most banks will, when they have knowledge of an appointment in a will, by the way, I should cover this point too. Where should you keep your will? You have only one original document. Don't sign two wills. Don't sign the original and a copy. You may have three places. You may keep your will at home, never. Safe deposit box, possibly so. Your attorney is one good alternative. He might keep in his own safe deposit box, but preferably keep it with the bank that is named in the instrument. And all you keep at home is what we call a conformed copy. It's a copy of the instrument without a signature, but it has typed on the last page the names of the witnesses. So it's an exact duplicate. We know who the witnesses are. And keep that instrument at home. Now, when you... Pardon me? I don't like them. I don't like a photocopy of the origin of the instrument because some of these photocopies look doggone near as good as the original, and there could be some contesting. So then, when the bank is named, a good bank is named, and you deposit either a conformed copy or the original document in that with that bank, it becomes that bank's responsibility to monitor your file every 2 or 3 years and to call you and just say, it's been 3 years now since you prepared your will. Are there changes in your family situation? Are there changes in economic conditions and the like? If so, may we suggest that you come down and discuss it and see if there should be a codicil prepared, or maybe even a new will. But more important, and we're going to see this now, is that Congress is looking at changes in the tax, in inheritance tax laws, estate tax laws. And any good bank that has knowledge of their appointment will bring to your attention when and if the laws are changed that your will requires a modification or a codicil. Last in 1969, this happened in our bank. We put six paralegals in the basement of our bank for 3 months. We reviewed every will in the file at no expense and brought to the attention of the customer that his will or her will had to be changed to conform with the new laws. And you're going to see some new changes. Congressman Cui from Minnesota is on that committee. Alan, that's a good name out here. Joel was here, Lifestyle, Congressman of Southern Minnesota. And he feels, and he's quite committed, he told me this 2 years ago, that most likely the exemption of 60,000 as we see today will be changed to 150,000, but not all at one time. It'll be a graduated change over about 5 years. And we hope that this will not come out of Congress this year. They're too busy politicking, and they're going to go home pretty soon. So we anticipate the new Congress in next January will look at estate laws, and you'll see some changes come about. We don't think that it's going to favor, as Ford came out a while back in a speech in Iowa, that it's going to favor the small businessman, the farmer, because that's discriminatory. And we're going to find people that are going to have 10 acres that can say they're a farmer and they're entitled to those benefits. So we think that the overall exemption will be increased to 150,000 over a graduated period. Half the assets flow to the surviving spouse, and the other half are subject to taxation over 60,000.